Welcome to Forward, a podcast from Brock University's Faculty of Humanities. I'm your host, Allison Innes. When we think about the humanities, we're usually referring to disciplines like art, music, drama, language, literature, history. But one of the things that makes humanities such an exciting field of study is how well our research can connect with other fields such as sociology, healthcare, and science. That's why for today's interview, I made a trip across campus to the Department of Sport Management in the Faculty of Applied Health Science. My guest today is Taylor McKee, an assistant professor in sport management. His background in history has led him to publications on topics including Olympic history, sport and residential schools, hockey history, monuments and historical memory, and masculinity in hockey. In addition to his many scholarly articles, he also frequently publishes in The Conversation Canada, with articles this year on the NHL playoffs, LIV Golf, and Hockey Canada. Between teaching and research, he is also managing editor of the Journal of Emerging Sports Study and a researcher with the Indigenous Hockey Research Network. So welcome to Forward.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I'll just mention to our listeners that we sound a little bit different today because we are recording in your office, which I wanted to record in because you have so many amazing images and pictures and sports memorabilia. And there's always, you always have something cool whenever I stop by.
Thank you. I mean, I want to, going to someone's office is, I remember doing it. It's intimidating. It's a scary thing. And I remember going to some of these offices and they're just terrifying. There's the papers everywhere. Well, there's a lot of stuff around here. But for your listeners to hear, it's not organized. But I remember that feeling of like, I feel like I'm interrupting someone in the middle of, you know, discovering the theory of relativity. So I'm cognizant of that, trying to make it a little more of a friendly experience. It's like that's sort of the doctor's office theory. You're like, no one really looks forward to going to talk to someone in their office. Oftentimes they can be distressed or, you know, in need of help. Yeah. So trying to make that a little bit easier.
Well, you do have a friendly office, for sure. And so you have a background in history. Now, you did your undergrad and your MA in history. I'm not sure, was your PhD in history as well?
They didn't offer like a history sports PhD. My coursework was in the history department at Western. But so ostensibly, my work was in history. My degree is from kinesiology, actually.
Okay.
Never taken a kinesiology course, though. I've never taken a single one.
Do you want me to edit that out?
No, leave it. No, of course. I'm not the only one that has that sort of trajectory at Western. There's very few places that offer the study of history of sport. You know, it's something I talk about frequently. If I was going to say, you know, I'd like to study German expressionist film from the early 20th century, they were like, yes, good for you. Very good. You know, if I want to study art or opera or any of these sort of parts of popular culture, I don't really have a problem with that in the history departments, generally speaking, or in film studies departments. But sport history is seen as not necessarily worthy of academic pursuit. There's a great quote about history of England. The gentleman says that we know more about the history of the drains on the ground at Oldham, which is a place in England that has a soccer team, than the hundreds of thousands of people that go there every single day to watch sports. We know less about them and why they were doing that, but we know a lot about the sewage system underneath it. And like that's sort of a great example, is that we sometimes denigrate sport to this this sort of frivolity that doesn't get a serious academic pursuit. So that's why you're sort of forced to go to different places to get a PhD, if that makes sense.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I don't come from having an interest in sports. And when I was growing up, I perceived hockey as something that was very violent. And that's something I know your research looks into. And so it just didn't appeal to me. And it wasn't until the Canada Games came to Brock and some of our researchers started thinking about how sports connects with different aspects of humanities that I really started to think about it differently and think about the role that sport plays in society and the kinds of questions that we can ask about it. So how does history and sport fit together for your research?
Right. Well, I mean, when we study sort of the more straightforward approaches to history, we can... And if we ignore things like music and art and film and sport, sometimes we can obscure what living actually felt like during this period. And this happens frequently. I mean, if you tried to study, say, for instance, sometimes in sport, studying sport, you can forget about the sort of history side, but it's harder to do that, frankly. And the intersections are fairly obvious. You spoke about the 72 Summit series is a great example here. So understanding that series... And if you're not familiar, it's a game between the USSR and Canada that took place in 1972, organized as a showcase of the best Canadian players playing against the best Soviet players. There is no way to possibly understand that series as a hockey tournament specifically, right? You have to understand it as an expression of the Cold War. You get a sense of what the 70s were like. You get a sense of the angst of the 70s, this sense of impending doom around every corner. I mean, you had the the 1969, you have Woodstock, you have the moon landing, you have Abbey Road comes out, like, still a bit of optimism in the world. The 70s is a different place, you know, I mean, Vietnam has taken a huge turn, obviously it had in the 60s as well. You get that sense, and again, the lived experience, and if you're into social history, if you're into sort of history from below, sport is a great entry point into that. And we can talk about what the sort of diplomatic history of the Cold War was and the history of various, initiatives from the federal government to try and build relationships between the Soviet Union and Canada. Or we can look at the Summit Series and just say, what would it have been like to have lived through those moments? What did the average Canadian know about the Soviet Union? Well, that's hard to do. You have to look at CBC stuff or, you know, have a look at, I guess, surveys. But you listen to the way that people talked about the Soviet team during that era and you learn a lot about the Cold War. So if sports gives us an entry point to talking about so many different topics from the past, that's something that I really appreciate is that, for instance, my research is in the early 20th century, my doctoral research was, and you learn so much about modernity and, you know, the results of the First World War and, you know, the idea of displacement and, you know, mortality really coming to a head in the way that people sort of understood sport coming out of the First World War in 1918 and on. And we learn about, you know, views towards professionalism, views towards racial minorities, views towards indigenous people. I mean, you can just see these things play out throughout sport history. And you can do it in a way in which you understand how the average person would have understood it. And in conventional history, those pursuits can be very difficult. It's a pretty dense way to look through history. You have to try and peek into the sort of history from below angles. And I find sports a really excellent entry point to the past. So that's what got me sold on it, because that wasn't my initial, obviously, background in studying history.
Where did you start with studying history? What pulled you into history?
I still like this project. You know, I started my master's program at the University of Victoria. I had this idea that I would study existentialism and post-World War II France. And I would study existentialism as a study of resistance and the notion that of culpability, saying that you were personally responsible as an expression of collaboration. And I was TAing at University of Victoria. And I saw that they have a course in the history department. History departments are getting creative, and they're offering, you know, very, very different things than they used to on the history of hockey. I was like, what are you talking about? You can have a history of hockey course? This exists in the world? Please let me TA it. That was a moment for me where I loved that stuff I was doing, but the extent to which I could engage with that material and the level I would need to get to, the amount I need to do, as opposed to something that was a part of my daily life and my things that I actually enjoyed doing. And certainly, you know, if you're pursuing graduate study, and I know that our wonderful host here is doing that as well, being selfish in those ways is a productive, you know, pursuit. What do you like to do? I mean, you're going to have to go into these situations where you're going to stare at blank documents, you're going to have to comb through archives in the history world. It better be something you would like, even if it's just something, a subject matter that fascinates you. So finding out that I could do that at a more sophisticated level, that was, you know, earth-changing for me, and that led me where I was am today.
So had you grown up playing hockey, watching hockey?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. A very conventional sort of relationship to hockey. Played it growing up, played baseball, loved sports in that way. But again, that's the candy, right? I mean, I had, you know, traditional academic pursuits. That's what I was here for. I mean, went all through my undergrad. I had a sort of side gig working at student newspapers as the sports editor, and that was sort of my sports fix, and then my conventional academics was like a separate world. But the idea was, you know, this is what I love, what is my free time. I can't really mix those two things together. Normally, that's not a good idea. This has been extremely wonderful. Every single day, I tell every one of my students this. It's just still surreal to me getting to walk in, and later on this evening, I'll be talking about sports as a serious academic subject again. And that's one of the things that Brock really has, is a community of people, everyone on this floor and the floor below me, that take this subject matter seriously. And that's not a given. I mean, you know, when you're scattered throughout the wilderness of the university and you, oh, I'm a cultural historian, or, oh, I study, you know, recreation and leisure. I can proudly say here that I study sport, and that's not something that many universities offer. And I think that's been a huge benefit to Brock's, certainly their university, is the ability to offer courses in sports studies in general and to have recreation and leisure as well right next to it. So yeah, that's just such a wonderful thing about my job here, Brock.
So what courses are you teaching right now?
It's so cool. I get to teach sport policy. I'm teaching a course on nonprofits in sport, nonprofit management in sport. I'm teaching a course on the hockey industry, which is, again, surreal that I can do that. So awesome. Teach a course on professional development, 1P94. It's called Professional Engagement for the Sport Industry. Teach a course on diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is more related to a lot of my research pursuits, how to build inclusive spaces in sport. And that's what sort of I'm at right now. I think I have about a roster of 6 courses that I teach off and on at Brock.
Excellent. So when you're engaging with your students, what kinds of things do you think history and kind of that training in history and some of the thinking and ways we approach things in history, what does that add to a sports management student? What's the advantage for them for thinking about the history of sports?
That's a great question. I mean, I will tell you what I hope it does. I mean, it might say nothing at all, right? But for instance, we're talking about this with, this is the start of semester, we were talking about the Lou Marsh Award, which is an award given out to the greatest Canadian athlete. They win an award called the Lou Marsh Award. And there was a lot of hubbub recently about renaming the Lou Marsh Award because, whoops, no one had actually read things that Lou Marsh had written for a long time. And it turns out he had said some absolutely horrendous things about Jewish people, about Indigenous people, about Black people. And there was an effort to rename the award. Now, this is a great example of how, so in this course here, I get them to just read Lou Marsh columns. The interesting thing was the movement to rename the award was done by a cadre of very senior scholars, some of the oldest and most established sports scholars in Canada. But you know who was blamed for it? It was a bunch of young people. If you look at the comment sections of every story about renaming, it was, oh, this generation can't take a joke. This generation's a bunch of softies. Oh, you kids, you kids, you kids. The perception is that young people were unable to deal with a changing world. It's not true. So a lot of the times, this younger generation, the generation that's going to be undergraduates here, are blamed for things that come from the past that they've inherited that has nothing to do with them. So introducing them to the issues from the past as a way of understanding the world that they've essentially inherited is, I think, important, because I think sometimes you can get kind of defensive learning about the world, whether it's, you know, the residential school model or, you know, a history of sort of racism in Canadian institutions, something like that. And younger people can feel like they're being blamed or they're being, you know, held responsible for the sins of their grandparents. I mean, that's just not the way that this essentially works. So using the past to sort of explain those issues, not to mention the fact that, you know, opening their horizons to what's occurred before and that even our circumstances, even a pandemic, for instance, is a circumstance that we can draw strength from the past, right? I mean, that's something that, again, I think that when it comes to sport management, we talk about this in sport policy, that, you know, the crafting of policy is essentially artful theft in some ways. You have to keep revising things from the past, and even mask mandates. One of the earliest precedents for mask mandates were baseball mandates, where they forced baseball players to wear masks during the Spanish flu. And they use those as precedent to create mask mandates for public health regulations in Canada and the United States afterwards. So, you know, there's lots of reasons to use the past. I personally, you bring it into everything because when we can seem like a scary world if it just feels like every single day is a new horror that's never existed before. And I think that that's something you can get sort of sucked into feeling when you're presented with problem after problem after problem in the sports industry.
And certainly understanding the context that your sport of choice comes out of and how it has been influenced by things that have happened, but also how it has influenced society in other ways.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the question of context is an interesting one because history, that's our big selling feature. It's like, oh, context and change, or continuity and change and context. And that's exactly true. I mean, the truth is there an appetite for context in some of these issues? Probably not. You have to kind of almost develop that sort of appetite in students and sort of say that, like, if you seek to understand why it is that we've gotten to this situation, you have to be empathetic towards people from the past. You have to be empathetic to the people towards. And I think that context, you know, essentially saying like, well, you know, well, everyone talked like that in the old days. You know, it's not Lou Marsh's fault. That's just the way that people spoke. Well, that's an example of using context, I think, incorrectly, where it's like, well, you know, lots of people said crazy stuff in the old days, and we should just essentially forgive all the people from the past. That's not really context, right? I mean, if we talk about this with slavery in Canada, we talk about this with many issues where it's like, well, you know, we did this way, but the Americans were worse, or we do certain issues but, you know, it was just commonplace at the time. If we don't really understand what commonplace means, if we don't understand what was commonly said, or understand that there were resistance issues at the time as well. For instance, you know, in my own world, I talk about violence in hockey and this idea that, like, well, hockey's always been violent. And that's true. Now, that is absolutely true. In fact, it was deadly in the early days. People died frequently, but they did die. And once is
pretty... There's some pretty gruesome stories out there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And we're talking right now in the aftermath of someone dying on the ice, unfortunately, you know?
Yes.
The truth is,
and now there's a debate about neck guards and what to do about that. But that event isn't in isolation. That event is part of a much longer conversation about violence and safety.
Definitely. And, you know, the question of how the courts are going to deal with this. Well, we've had homicides in the past, or, you know, manslaughter trials in our country that deal with this very issue. So seeing it, I don't know when you're listening to this, if what's already played out, but we're going to see a European court deal with this issue. The truth is, you know, when it comes to violence, specifically, they'll talk about hand-to-hand combat, fighting, and that kind of stuff. Yes, it's always been there, or parts of it always been there, but people looking around and saying, I don't like this, has also always been there. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of how, you know, fuller understanding of what context is, and I think that a social history view of these things is helpful, is important, where understanding that, okay, so just because things occurred didn't mean that, you know, this is essentially the way that things were all the time. This is sort of brings us to this notion of a Whiggish view of history, which is everything that led us to where we are today is correct, and everything that didn't is incorrect. Well, there were people that were saying we should not have hand-to-hand combat in our hockey in 1915, 1920, 1930. There were people in the 60s that said, you know, I hate this stuff. There were people that looked at the Summit Series and were embarrassed by the conduct of Canadians. It doesn't mean, though, that necessarily that saying, looking around and saying, we probably shouldn't have X or Y in hockey, or we should make things safer, is a... Like, one of the ways that this is used incorrectly is the notion that if you seek to reform, you are being untrue to the game's heritage. Well, the heritage, there's a long heritage of people trying to reform the game, right? And that's true in other social issues, right, with this. Where it's like, well, this is un-Canadian to, you know, rename Sir Johnny McDonald High School or whatever. I mean, like, that is, it's extremely Canadian to be trying to, you know, improve, and I hope that that is a notion of Canadianness that we can get behind. That, you know, we are a people that hopefully has a view of our own past and a clear-eyed view of what is important to us. So, it's deeply Canadian, I think, to pull down statues and put up new ones and rename stuff, and who cares? I mean, just don't stop looking at the past. That's kind of one of the messages I like to bring in with sport.
So I want to come back to this idea of violence and masculinity, because I know it's something that you've spent a lot of time thinking about and you've written a lot about, too. And again, as I said, I don't come from a background of being interested in sport and following sport and stuff. And so I was really interested in learning that with the Summit Series that, if I'm recalling correctly, Canadians played a very kind of thuggish game. It was very much about the violence and the fighting and that kind of thing. As opposed to some of the Soviet strategies at the time. And so I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about this idea of how violence and masculinity and Canadian is, and like being Canadian kind of all gets lumped together in this particular hockey package.
Yeah, this is one of the wonderful things about when you go to university, you get to meet people who come from other places. And, you know, when you're in high school, when you're just around your family members, you can hear stories about the past, you hear about the 70s, you hear about the 60s, how the way things were. You get a very sort of parochial view of what the world is, right? And university, one of the reasons you should go to university is to expand those horizons forcibly, right? You are forced to sit next to people who aren't from the same place. And one of the exercises you can do in this way is ask somebody from anywhere in the world. Ask someone from Poland, ask them from Pakistan. Ask them, do you have a national myth that says, you know, like, we're strong, but not as strong as Canada, right? If you ask Croatians, do they have a national myth that says that Croatians are weak? Every single nation on Earth has some sort of notion that their country is strong in various ways. Canadians seem to think we have a monopoly on the notion of toughness, right? And it's one of the things that I think is really, really bizarre. If you don't think Soviets saw themselves as strong, you know nothing about Russian history. I mean, like, the notion that the Russians are seen as this sort of effeminate, very fancy, very frilly form of the game, and Canadians in 72 played this robust, masculine form of the game, and that the Soviets were okay with that distinction, I mean, that's just not the way it was. So this is one of the things that, you know, is helpful when you're talking about masculinity, is that nobody owns a monopoly on the notion of what is masculine or what is tough. The troublesome part in Canada is this becomes the prescriptive notion of what being Canadian means. You got to live and be a certain way. There's a great example of this. There's a 5'10" point guard, and point guards are positions where you can get away with being that small in basketball. And Fred VanVleet, he plays with the Houston Rockets, and he was playing in the playoffs with the Toronto Raptors, and he lost a tooth during the game. Reporters came up to him and said, like, how does it feel to be truly Canadian? These were Canadian reporters. He's like, is this what it means to be Canadian? I don't want any part of this. Like, losing half a tooth? Like, no way. He's from Rockford, Illinois. He's seen some hard stuff. Nobody would look at Fred VanVleet's life and say, this guy doesn't know what it means to be tough. But this notion of, like, a suffering bodily injury and, you know, undergoing pain, the Canadian public and Canadians believe that this is part of our kind of our national story in this way. And it goes back to dealing with this horrifying weather we have to deal with, and, you know, dealing with all the sort of pains and geography of Canada's, you know, environment, certainly. But again, we don't have a monopoly on that. Certainly Russia has a claim to those same things, and yet they are seen as the diametrically opposed to us, and they certainly were in 72. So an example of, you know, studying masculinity in this way, we need to understand that most of these things are myths. And, you know, I know that that's something that you study in your own life. I mean, myths are not necessarily true or untrue, but they, you know, reveal a lot about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is true that there are instances of bravery, of courage, of, you know, pain tolerances being exceeded and all those things. And whether or not we believe that to be positive or not, that it has happened with Canadian athletes. It's also happened with Americans and Russians and Germans and French and athletes from Algeria. And it's just, it's really not. So in sport, it gives us this opportunity to keep reinforcing narratives that that I think can create really harmful patterns in 10-year-olds, right? In 12-year-olds, in a 7-year-old playing hockey. That's the part that really gets at me when it comes to sport. Is that, like, okay, professionals, they want to believe in some myth about toughness, go for it. And they want to tell us things that make us feel better, like a warm blanket about what it means to be Canadian. It's probably okay. But how that affects little kids when they're out there and, you know, they're feeling hurt, or what they're willing to go through, or what they're willing to do for their team, or the things that they're willing to sacrifice.
Or what their coaches or parents are reinforcing.
Absolutely, right? What they're willing to ask those kids to do. That's the part that I think we need to really think and long hard about. Where, you know, okay, player breaks his leg and finishes the shift, Gregory Campbell, in the playoffs in 2011. Great. Cool. We can have posters of him, and then we can laud him for those things. Great. I don't want my kid going through anything like that. And your parents, whoever's listening to this, would not want that for you, right? And those types of messages that, while they appear innocuous in this way, that's something that we should look in long and hard about in terms of kinds of stories we're telling ourselves about what it means to be Canadian. How does that relate to some really nasty stuff as it relates to how it filters down to kids?
There's another kind of interesting angle of being Canadian in sport, and that's how sport is used or was used in residential schools and Indigenous connections with sport. And I know you've done some work around that and sport as a colonizing force.
Yeah, absolutely. So similar, exactly the same pathway. Well, if hockey is the sort of greatest expression of being Canadian, right? So it's just an example. You can talk about this in football and basketball throughout various points. You can talk about this in baseball in the early 1920s if you wanted to, but we'll focus on hockey for a second. There was a very distinct reason why hockey was brought into residential schools. I mean, again, we imagine so much of the residential school system to be accidental, to be byproduct of some sort of benevolent ignorance, right? It was constructed for very specific reasons. There's a reason that the architect of the residential school system, Ryerson, his name is being reevaluated. There's a reason for it. This was carefully and consciously constructed, right down to the fact that schools that spent very little on anything to do with student life did spend time, many of them, building hockey rinks, because they thought it was a way in which we could acculturate Indigenous kids into being Canadian, these right Canadian values that would sort of be brought into their lives. So unfortunately, look, we have this sort of very, very strange history of sport, specifically hockey, at residential schools, where many of those who survived residential school look back at their time with playing hockey saying, that was by far the best part about being there, right? That's what Willie Littlechild said, something similar to that. Eugene Arcand, one of the witnesses for the TRC, said something similar to that. And the tricky part is, you validate those experiences. Those are true things. I mean, I have no doubt that any of that was true. But what we can't do is then say, well, it must not have been so bad, right? And one of the problems is when you see pictures of kids playing hockey at residential schools, a lot of them they look amazing. They are perfectly combed hair, awesome gear, like brand new sticks, brand new gloves. And the pictures that come out, that's the sort of way in which many sporting fans have interacted with images of residential schools, of hockey teams. There was one, for instance, from Sioux Lookout, that traveled to Ottawa. They met representatives of the government. They had a big state dinner there, all to sort of demonstrate the success of the residential school system. And the problem is, when you see pictures, and then we had a specific research project about just pictures of them, you'd be surprised at the responses that people get from those who lived that era. I look at these pictures and think, like, that gear is nicer than the gear that I had. That looks better than my school. That may be even true, by the way, that you had better, nicer gear than you did. But that's the sort of thin end of the wedge. It's like, well, if they played hockey there, I've been told a bunch of stuff about res school being this horrible thing and, you know, how it's my fault, even though that's not necessarily the message. But that can be the sort of feeling, that defensiveness that we spoke of earlier. This is where this sort of tricky relationship between the acculturating force of hockey inside residential schools affects the cultural memory of the schools themselves. And that's a really dangerous sort of path to go on. So we go with this in our 1P93 class here about diversity and inclusion, where we talk about, you know, how to tell these stories responsibly. One of the analogies, it's a poor analogy, but, you know, if I threw you off a boat and then handed you a life raft, did I save your life? I mean, that's sort of the best example I could think of here, where, yes, I suppose that life raft here at hockey in that way got them through something that was horrible, but it's the same system that created the situation that needed saving in the first place. So while the sport itself can be seen as, you know, essentially a blameless tool used to sort of get them through a difficult thing, there's a reason it was there in the first place. And there was a reason that, you know, it was taught, and there was a reason that students were subjected to horrible conditions in residential school, and they're all kind of related.
Yeah, and that reason, again, and I'm also thinking of the example, like, with cricket and the British Empire, and how sport can become this way of saying, these are our values, and these are... So, again, with residential schools and hockey, through teaching some of these values about what it means to be Canadian, as a way of or as part of their strategy to make the Indigenous children not Indigenous anymore, and to inculcate them. And then kind of this level of images on top of that is very interesting, because then it kind of becomes propaganda and used in particular ways to tell particular stories about what is or isn't really going on.
Absolutely. Now you're really speaking about cricket being something that I'm desperately interested here at Brock. I mean, can't see around us here, but they're special little Waterloo Cup that was won here by our cricket team, which I'm assistant for. I
mean, excellent.
Cricket's a great example because cricket is a game that is a sport. Stephen Fry described it as a sheep. It looks really pretty from far away, but up close it's really nasty. That's kind of the way the cricket is. But cricket comes with forms of gentlemanly play and the notion of hockey is Canada's cricket in this way, right? Where it is seen as a force that you can throw at any situation. And if you allow children to play it, out will come Canadians, right? Mm. Same sort of way they play cricket. Out would produce fine, upstanding British gentlemen, right? We can make fun of the British for this sort of extremely, you know, antiquated view of things. But again, we believe that, you know, oh, we say, well, it teaches teamwork and it teaches perseverance. Yeah, well, you know, so does hopscotch if you do it in certain ways. I mean, that's not, again, I talk about this all the time, sport being a tool, right? Mm-hmm. It is neutral. It is not magical. It is not nefarious. It's a tool, right? Well, the residential school architects knew that, and they knew they used the tool in those ways. Doesn't mean that their experiences in sport weren't positive in a relative sense. It doesn't mean that they don't have a good lifelong relationship with sport itself. But to the general public, to people that weren't alive during the residential school model, or were alive and feel, you know, that they essentially are being held responsible, even though, again, that's not true, they can be, it warps our sort of cultural memory of a thing that was occurring in plain sight for a century. So sport as a tool for understanding what went on at residential school can be really tricky sometimes. Because again, if we understand hockey, you see kids playing hockey, you immediately think of your own life. Whether you played it or not, you've seen young kids playing it. You have this notion of pastoral sort of rinks in the, you know, or outdoor street hockey or whatever. And
you just need to look at our Tim Hortons coffee cups.
Or $5
at Christmas time. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, our literal currency was printed with it. And I think that's something that, again, and well, we could talk about the $5 bill if we want to later, because that's a fascinating story about, you know, that poem. It's built around, it's a separatism, you know, analogy, for example. But the point is that, like, at face value, like the sheep analogy of Stephen Fry, it looks beautiful and pastoral and very simple. Up close, it's gnarly and it's nasty and it's complicated. And that's, again, the way I like to describe it. Certainly sport in general, but the way that hockey is understood from residential school. And hockey wasn't the only sport that was played there. Basketball was played. Baseball was played as well. And it shouldn't change the way that we view the institution itself, which should, again, validate the stories that were told of people that went there and, you know, their experiences with sports. A miracle that many of them have positive relationships with sport now, but, you know, it does not change the makeup of the institution, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so you were involved in a research project where you used images of sport to elicit, like, I guess it would be an oral history kind of project using images from residential schools with residential school survivors.
Yes, and this is co-author on this study, and Alexander Giancarlo and Braden Tahiwi and Janice were the leads on this. But yeah, absolutely, same idea, using a technique called photo voice and the idea that, like, how are the emotions, what are the emotions elicited when they see images from survivors themselves? It sort of gets at the same idea, though, right? So Eugene Arcand has this wonderful speech he gave, and he described this scene, and his advice was, don't let the pictures fool you, right? And that is, again, that project where the sort of the photo voice techniques were an example of, you know, when we see the photo, when I see the photo, when people who are 17 years old see the photo, it's going to elicit certain things. But people who are there in the moment, this sounds like a basic thing, right? But sport tends to flatten some of the edges here, where it's like, oh, hockey, I get it. Basketball, I understand. Kids playing basketball, funnest time of their life, right? But when you actually ask the people that were part of these projects to elicit their emotions, you get fascinating stories about what was there. And that's true with most situations. But with residential schools specifically, this is something that is very important to us, specifically with regards to that Sioux Lookout team that traveled. That was where the project that we were part of there.
So I asked you earlier about some of the humanities skills and concepts and what they give sports management students. So I want to flip that question around and kind of, why should a history student or a humanities student in general take a curiosity in sport? What can we learn from sport management and the study of sport?
Right, so we'll take the sport part first, right? Where, you know, if you seek to understand how a population experienced an event, or if you're a history student and you want to start to understand the past and you want to understand how people understood a complicated world, which, by the way, the world's always been complicated and it's always been horrible and the world's always been ending, and, you know, this is sort of a way of understanding. You can look to sport as a way to sort of understand these issues, as a way to really reach the most core essential emotions of everyday life in a way that's really hard to do for most issues. For instance, if you want to understand sectarian violence in Northern Ireland, for instance, you can use sport as a way to sort of shortcut your way right into the heart of many of these issues. If you want to look to sectarian violence today You can use sport as a way of looking at the Old Firm matches in Glasgow, as a way of understanding how an issue that seems dead is white hot still. I mean, you can understand these sort of ways in which these issues play out even further. You want to understand South American regional rivalry and how this sort of plays out to, again, a continent to many North America that seems relatively uniform. You got Brazil and a bunch of Spanish-speaking nations, and, you know, some of them are big and some are small, and who knows the difference between them. Well, understanding sport in that region allows you to understand how deep-seated the differences and the things that are obvious. And certainly geography class could help you in this way, too. But if that's your goal, is to understand these events or these periods in history or these parts of the world, you can use sport because it's what people care about. It's what makes their lives enjoyable in some senses, right? I mean, yes, census data is important, but I mean, no one's waking up counting down the days to the next census, right? I mean, sport allows you to see people living lives in ways in which they are authentically enjoying themselves and authentically miserable and authentically, you know, hopeful and authentically hateful, right? I mean, you can see these emotions play out because sport taps into that sort of irrational part of society that's hard to sort of tease out, hopefully, normally, in polite society. So that's my appeal to, say, history students, sociology students in that way. So was your other question, what can sport management learn?
So how can a history student benefit from studying sport?
Holy moly. Sport, yeah. And sport management.
And sport management as well.
Holy moly, that's something I've learned. I mean, so it's great. I understand all these social conditions. I understand how power is expressed. And, you know, I understand all these techniques. Well, there's a big old world out there that's living and breathing and employing and producing. And it is a mechanism that, in a way that in history studies, the industry of history, whatever that means, be that teaching or museum studies or whatever, I mean, the industry of history, capital I, is a small one. That's okay. That's totally fine. I wish it was larger. I wish there were more museum positions, and I wish that it wasn't the case. It's probably not the case. So one of the great appeals is that, first of all, it forces me to contend with the real world, which is something that, you know, in the humanities, we can luxuriate sometimes and maybe disassociating from the events of the present. That is really helpful here. I can talk about things that are going on right now. I can talk about scandal, and I can talk about, you know, disrepair and institutions that are crumbling or in need of repair. There's a sport policy coming out probably by the end of this year. That's going to affect people's lives. That's going to affect people's lives for the next 10 years. That's what sport management brings to you, is this understanding of this leviathan that's out there, this gigantic beast that is, you know, a $1 trillion global industry, right? That is something that, again, if you love sport, if you care about it, if you seek to work in it, understanding the mechanisms that make that beast work are important. And again, it's not necessarily the first instinct of the humanities to look towards an industry. And that's good. Liberal arts shouldn't be a job training site, right? But sport management as sort of a way of understanding, you know, how one can put food on the table in this industry, or how can live a fulfilling career, you know, working at an institution that might be flawed, that might have problems, that might need to be revised. That's the sort of appeal I would make to a humanities student, is they can teach you how to actually affect the change that we know needs to be made in a way that a study of sociology or history, or sometimes, you know, in other facets, we can understand the problems. There's just no way of understanding actually now, okay, go get hired by industry X, and here's how the board works, and here's how the governance strategies work, and here's how you get money. Like, that allows you to really make change in a meaningful way if you understand how the operation actually works. That's my sort of appeal.
I think that's a strong one. I'm almost ready to sign up for some
classes myself.
Come on in. So one project I wanted to ask you about, which I think is really interesting, is the journal that you helped co-found, the Journal of Emerging Sport Studies.
Yeah.
So tell us, what is this? So I guess for our non-academic listeners, we should explain what a journal is.
Yeah.
And how it's different from something like a magazine.
Well, hey, I mean, that's the core issue here, is what is a journal? That's the question we asked ourselves, which was like, so, look, it stems from a process we'll help explain what a journal is, and learning about this is, look, you're a PhD student yourself right now. Perhaps when someone's listening to this in the future, you're already graduating, you're well on your way here. But one of the pressures that's levied upon you is you have to produce outputs. You have to be a person who writes articles and does these sorts of things. You have to be a public intellectual in these ways. You need to contribute to a research community. Well, it's a hard process. It's a long process. Asking graduate students to do it is one of the crueler things you can do, because the time frames are so long. And the project takes so long to sign off on, it takes a long time to sort of produce it. But you have to sort of learn how to produce these things in a relatively short order. Journals are institutions and organizations and associations that essentially validate and operationalize knowledge production. And that's all they are. I mean, they are, and they are extremely crucial in that function, especially today. I sound like an old man, but it's like, you know, every single day that goes by, you understand the purpose of these journals, whether it's journals that have been around forever, like Nature in Science, whether it's journals of immunology that validate studies of COVID vaccines, or journals of history that sort of say this is what, you know, the generally accepted practices from the past are. They serve an important function. The way in which journals operate, though, is a relatively obtuse one. Now, they find experts in peer review, they subject them to rigorous peer review standards and reviews that go back and forth. And for literally over a century, that's sort of the way that this all has worked. And peer review is a system that has limitations, certainly, but has generally worked.
So we have talked about peer review before, I think, but just kind of as a refresher. So if I'm writing an article, I write my article, I get my supervisor to look at it, I tweak it halfway to death, I format it, and then I send it off to the journal. And then at some point, the journal is going to say to me, we're interested in this, we're going to send it out to review. And so there's probably usually three, I think,
between two and four.
So they send it out to a couple of academics that I don't know, that don't know me. It's often, not always, but it's often anonymous.
Yeah, it should be anonymous.
And they read the article and they say, well, you didn't cite this person, this idea is problematic, you need to reframe this. And then the editor sends all of that feedback back to me as the author. And I need to either incorporate it or explain why I didn't address these particular things. And that makes the article stronger. And so when the article does come out, it carries a little bit more weight.
Definitely.
Right? Have I got it?
You nailed it. You nailed it. And the truth is, those experts are brought in because they should know what's out there. Because half the time, you're working from a very limited body of knowledge. And it's possibly just missing something, right? The only part that we didn't get over there is when they send that back, they also send it back, hey, we like it. Hey, we don't like it. Hey, we kind of like it. Hey, it's perfect. I'll eat my hat if I can find it accepted with no revisions. I mean, that is just so rare. This gets at sort of the peer review thing that we try to revolutionize here. Revolutionize. We try to change. We try to revolutionize far beyond what we were doing.
Oh, let's aim high. Let's aim high.
The idea here is, okay, so that's the sort of model. And on that basis, things have been working okay. The problem is, so first of all, there's also a first stage here, which is called a desk reject, which means it doesn't even make it to review. They look at this and like, no thanks. Desk reject. It happens. It's a part of life.
And sometimes that's, it just doesn't fit what the journal wants to publish, or...
There's a million reasons why desk rejections occur. There's everyone who's been in this industry has a story of a desk rejection that gets denied by a smaller journal, gets accepted by a larger one. Like, it happens all the time. So, it requires a large amount of persistence. Because also, by the way, you can submit to one journal at a time. You can't submit to more than one. Most say it will tell you that up front. So if you're submitting to one, you gotta wait months and months and months to find out whether or not you've even been denied, to then therefore be able to submit to another one. So you're talking years here. Years in most of these situations. So we're in this sort of model here, and we were going through this process, and I had some wonderful luck and it's good success in my doctoral work in getting stuff through, but I was working with my doctoral advisor at the time, and she showed me the peer review comments she received on one of our articles. She is I would say that she is probably the preeminent Indigenous scholar of sport in Canada right now. And I saw the feedback she received on one of her articles. An article that ended up getting published, by the way. It was awesome. And I thought to myself, this is inhumane. Some of the stuff that was being said. It was disrespectful. It was rude. It was needlessly cruel and uninformed feedback. And this was from a very reputable journal. It was this moment. It was really eye-opening for me. Because I assumed treatment like that was everyone I was going through grad school. This is just normal because we were young and stupid. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. You start to see it actually as a function of the industry itself because, again, peer reviewers are overtaxed. They can become frustrated easily, obviously, because the peer review, there's not very many incentives to actually do this stuff. So we're like, okay, so what's the journal? What do we actually need? If we want to create our own that focused on servicing scholars that are trying to break into the field, who maybe are trying to sort of crack this egg, how would we do that? What would we need? And we realized that you don't need very much. What you need are help from people who are already on their way. We got the editorial board popped up. Really quickly, it was just me and two other PhD students at Western, and we assembled an editorial board of people way more serious than we were in the industry at the time, and then it was a matter of just finding reviewers, and we sort of launched this idea with this kind of like, you know, punk rock idea of we can just do this ourselves. We as long as we just commit to the principles of peer review and the same rigors that they're doing, we can do it in a more humane way. So for instance, when we were doing this, we wanted to focus that if you were submitting to this journal, even if it was and had absolutely no business anywhere near an academic journal, the feedback that you'd receive would not make you never want to do it again. And that happens frequently, is that they'll try once, it's a scarring experience. It takes 6 months. At the end of it, you're left with someone that says basically quit now while you're behind. And you're like, well, great. I'm really glad I'm paying money for this experience, right? So the idea is we can do this humanely. We try so hard to be humane in our responses. We try to be humane in our response times. And we're not saying this because journals do this are inhumane or deliberately cruel. Is the institutions have gotten so large. I mean, we're just trying to put a human touch on most of this stuff. So also, like, instead of doing the review model where it's accept with minor revisions, accept with major, we have different ways of doing it so that it's an indication of how long that they think the feedback will take to actually complete, rather than, you know, everyone essentially who's accepted gets accepted with minor or major. Nobody gets accepted at all. And then there's the rejections. So that was our plan. We thought we'd get half a dozen grad students in our first year, maybe, and that would be it. Maybe some people from Western. Well, unfortunately, this thing, fortunately and unfortunately, has grown extremely large. And it's not just grad students, which, in fact, we really have to take a concerted effort to try and refocus ourselves to help these emerging scholars, because it's supposed to be emerging topics and emerging scholars. Scholars that are new or topics that are not don't fit traditional sports scholarship. And so if it's like hiking or outdoor things or gambling studies in sport, we really want to help sort of have a wide view. Because again, what do we need to make sure that that's of high quality? We just got to find experts in those fields. We just got to do the elbow grease. And it's been a labor of love. And certainly we've actually have two more managing editors that have come on here. Melissa Ottermine, who works at Special Olympics in Denver. And Maya, who works she's from Halifax. She's that's sort of the managing editing team right now. And again, the quality of work that we have had submitted to us is mind-blowing to me still. Like, because there must be a need for it. Oh, and also, by the way, it's open access. That's the most important thing. Like, anyone can read it, right?
Because some of those big journals, you either have to have access to them through an academic university, or you have to pay $40 or $50 or more sometimes.
For an article, yeah.
Just to read an article. So these are, so again, the argument for open access is anybody can read it who is interested in it. You don't have to have academic connections or kind of know how to use the system to get access to it.
And I think if you had asked anyone who's an editorial person at any journal, they would say, I wish it was open access to their journal. There were very real capitalist forces that forced journals to have to take in this kind of money. Those forces are getting worse, by the way. And some of them, which went from being, we need this to survive, and it has become a little more, and there's a lot of people out there that are talking about the kind of more predatory versions of capitalism that are bringing in to the academic journal world, where there's essentially these multinational corporations that own publishing in this way that are doing pretty well by selling journal subscriptions to universities. But our little journal is indexed through a university library here. It was at Thomson Reuters University. Now it's here at Brock. So that means that it shows up on the university searches. It shows up on Google Scholar. It shows up everywhere else. Every other article would too. So if you publish with us, you get the same reach as you would have with the big guys. But anybody can read it. And many people, yourself included, I'm sure when you're doing research, your hope is, one day, I can share it with people. Imagine also you're doing research with a community, like an indigenous community, for instance. Mm-hmm. Spend all this time there and spend all this trust that has to be built up, and you do this longitudinal study. It takes years and years and years. And at the end of the day, you produce an article that you have to either download for them and send them as an email attachment, but they can't even view unless you're an active university student with the university's journal subscription. Well, that doesn't seem right. So, you know, what can we do to help fix that? I mean, we can offer open access just basically because we don't care about the server costs for our website. It's all the only expense we have, right? And the blood, sweat, and tears of our wonderful little volunteers. But you know, our little journal, we call it Jess, because Journal of Emerging Sports Studies. Jess has become something that is very dear to the people that have worked on it. And I still pinch myself when I look at the caliber of submissions, because I think even established scholars appreciate, you know, a humane touch. I saw that in the earliest days there, right, with my advisor, seeing that they're treated so poorly sometimes by reviewers. Even if the ideas are valid, it's just that the repartee between peer reviewers can be so toxic. So we try and avoid that kind of thing and try and make all the recommendations, even when they're harsh and even when it's a rejection and even when it's no, not be something that makes you want to give up on the enterprise altogether.
Yeah, in my PhD class just the other day, we were talking about academic identity and kind of that individual person alone at a desk doing their research versus kind of that more collaborative image. And sometimes we default, or sometimes just our research kind of takes us in a direction where we start to kind of isolate ourselves a little bit and forget that what we are doing needs to be collaborative with other communities around us.
Yeah, or else we risk becoming what, you know, the people that don't see value in universities, we're becoming what they say we are, which is this ivory tower of, you know, very smart people who don't talk to anybody, right? And, you know, universities are just this unbelievable well and reserve of very intelligent, very hardworking people. But if they don't interact with a larger community of people that either, you know, most of them are university grads themselves, don't understand what universities are, but most of them just need to be sort of coaxed into that sort of interactive sort of atmosphere. And again, open source journals are helpful in that way, because it's like there's absolutely no way now that they can't view what you're talking about. It also opens you up to a wider scope of criticism and responsibility. We also have this little thing called emerging discourses, where if there is something that's going on in the world right now and you want to have 1,000 worlds to have it, what we call critical commentaries. Sorry, critical commentaries and emerging discourses is the same sort of idea here. There's a space for you to just comment on something that's going on right now. So if an expert has an idea, whether it's about doping in sport or something that they feel like they can just give a commentary on, there's space to do that as well. In our emerging discourses, we have audio interviews, we have video interviews, we have question and answers with teachers, with athletes, just less sort of traditionally academic space as well.
And that gives you flexibility and that to respond to something, whereas going through traditional journal routes, it might be 6 months or a year and the people have forgotten about whatever that original
was. Definitely. I mean, you look at the stuff that's coming down the pike right now, it's like COVID. And it's like, how do we dealt with COVID? And it's like, we're 3 years on. And it's like, you know, I mean, yes, they produce COVID stuff quickly. Certainly on the sciences, that's a different universe. But yeah, I mean, it takes forever. It takes forever. For good reason, right? We got to be careful. We have to make sure that what we're doing is worthwhile. But, you know, if there's something that needs to be out there right away, that sports lends itself to this way, because there's always sports going on. We have space for that as well, so that it doesn't have to. So we have our traditional journal, we have critical commentaries, and we have emerging discourses in that way.
Yeah. So for our listeners who are interested in this kind of conversation, I am working at getting an expert in what we call knowledge mobilization, but it's just really a fancy word for how we take the research that we are doing and connect it with other scholars and also with people outside of the university as well. So I'm hoping that is a conversation that will be continuing in other episodes. And as part of your knowledge mobilization work, in addition to Jess, you also publish quite frequently in The Conversation.
Oh yeah, The Conversation.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in writing for The Conversation and what that's like, because that's written for a public audience.
Yeah, and what a wonderful tool The Conversation is. I mean, the idea being here, the same sort of premise. Universities are filled with all these wonderful experts in various subjects. Not myself, not included in that. But smarter people than I am that talk about, you know, everything from hard sciences, astronomy, sociology, gender studies, you name it. And there are issues going on right now. And wonderful part of the conversation is, first of all, it's short. It forces you to write in brief, deliberate. And you work with people who are professionals in sort of the journalism space who are able to be like, shorten this up. Like, and if you even have a readability score that makes sure that you're keeping things at a level that makes sense. That's a great exercise for anyone who's interested in academia, to force yourself in that way. But as a tool, because also this is a dissemination tool, The Conversation is used by traditional legacy media institutions as well. I mean, as a, you know, unfortunately, because those institutions are declining, it's an access point for high quality work. The Conversation has been wonderful for me because, first of all, sometimes I reach out and like, hey, I've got this idea. Is something you're interested? Most of the time they will reach out to me. And it's just a wonderful place where you can work with people that allow you to kind of have that latitude. So whether it was, you know, early on with Janice and I, when we were writing about sport policy when I was in my doctoral work, that was the first sort of way I was into, which, again, it was about, you know, this sounds familiar. This was happening back in 2018, a scandal at Hockey Canada. And it was, you know, there are policy solutions at play here. So again, something's happening right now and accessing that level of expertise. So again, if you're in academia right now and this is something that you're interested in, if you're a member of the public, I mean, Conversation is just, it's like the best newspaper you'll ever read. Like, you just go there and it's just issue X, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's about, you know, the U.S. elections, is an access point to people who, you know, maybe don't necessarily talk to the public very much, right? That's another thing, is that like many of the people who find The Conversation are experts in their field. You know, it's funny because one of the things I wrote for The Conversation was a piece about neck guards, if you can believe it, in the prescient nature. Again, if you're listening to this right now, there's such a horrible situation where a person was injured. And it was with an undergraduate student who played on the women's hockey team. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't use her as a co-author for this very reason. But I mean, it was a great way of getting her experiences out there to a larger public and say, just of this specific topic, Hockey Canada's rulebook says that all women and children need to wear neck guards. That's the rulebook. That's how it says.
Just the women?
Just the women and children. After 18, it's optional for men. So our point was, you've got to be kidding me. Essentially, like, was the point here? This is a crazy way to write a rule. This is an example of the sort of vestigial levels of sexism that are involved in the actual policy documents of our sporting system. Because it's like, I could talk about this stuff, you know, in a journal article. It's going to take 4 years to produce. And, you know, maybe that's a great model for that. But some of these smaller things that need to be talked about right now, you can access this stuff very, very, very quickly. And The Conversation is, they also have just so many great resources for, you know, distributing your, for done dissemination side, on the knowledge mobilization sort of piece. They can do things that you would take you years from a university to build up those levels of resources. So they're so handy. And I know that...
You don't need a subscription to read the conversation either. Exactly. So it's completely free, completely open access.
Absolutely, yeah.
And newspapers sometimes pick up those articles and share them out.
Absolutely. And then again, is that the greatest sense of you know, how newspapers supposed to work? Probably not. But I mean, look, I'll take that over, you know, in wire stories over and over and over again. But it's great. It's been good for me. And I love writing for them because, again, it forces me to write to the public, to be clear in my thoughts. And academia does not do a great job enforcing clarity sometimes. I mean, verbosity and you know, extensiveness and thoroughness, yes. But clarity and brief and brevity are things that I think are a premium when you're dealing with the it certainly helps your teaching as well, because you can be clear and brief when you're teaching as well.
Definitely. So just before we finish, we are in your office with all of your wonderful images and memorabilia. And so I would love for you to pick one, if you can pick one, and tell us a story about it and why it resonates with you.
Oh my goodness. So again, for your listeners, I've got like a corner in the back corner of my room, which I sort of describe as my shame of fandom corner. This is all my fan stuff I had, you know, since I was a little kid. My core of what I liked as what brought me to sport in the first place. A lot of it also is like music stuff and things like that. I think this is corny, but I like this thing. This is a quote here on my wall here from it's a Sartre quote. Now I don't speak French, but nous sommes nos choix, that we are our choices. I like that poster. I like that. I like looking at it all the time. That's a sort of a nice thing. It reminds me, this is where my work started. But the notion that we are our choices, I like that. And we're not who we are, you know, when we're born. We're who you've chose to be. I like that as sort of idea, as an operational understanding of, you know, sport in general. I mean, again, in academia, I like looking at that. That one always helps me look at that. And again, that, though, is probably my favorite piece of memorabilia.
That being?
This, if you... Sorry, I'm pointing to it. It's a Brock cricket jersey signed by the entire cricket team from our very first year of operations here at Brock. That we started a cricket team last year. A student of mine in sport policy was like, hey, I'm interested in cricket. Why don't we have a cricket team abroad? And I was like, I don't know. Let's make one. So we made one. And we created a code of conduct. And we got ratified by the varsity club committee. And they won the Waterloo Cup, which is also sitting right here. And I just, it's meaningful. Because those guys really, they go through a lot. International students, they suffer. I mean, like, it's a tough world for them. I mean, especially during the pandemic when we created that team. I mean, I gained a lot of understanding of how hard their lives are, how hard they work, and how, you know, a lot of the challenges that to most students just aren't visible. I mean, the pressure that's on these kids. I mean, our team was 16 people. I think 13, 12 of them were international students. They're from all parts of the Indian subcontinent for the most part. Like, so they're signing it all like that. That's very meaningful because I like that and I like seeing it. It reminds me of like, right, that's something that's... No journal article ever provide that much enjoyment that these guys had playing that season. So that's helpful.
Yeah, you made a huge difference in a lot of lives, I guess. Thank you so much for joining us today. I always enjoy and appreciate our conversations, and I always learn so much from you. So hopefully our listeners, I'm sure our listeners did as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Forward. Find our footnotes, links to more information, transcripts, and past episodes on our website, brocku.ca/humanities. We love to hear from our listeners, so join us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @brockhumanities. Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. Forward is hosted and produced by Allison Innes for the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Sound editing is by Serena Atella, and theme music is by Khaled Amam. This podcast is financially supported by the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University.